The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the New York Times best-selling author James Rawlinson. He's got a brand new Sigma Force novel titled Bloodline. James, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
All right, Bloodline, Sigma Force novel. How long has this series been active?
This is book number 8. Sigma Force, for those that aren't familiar with the group, is a group of former Special Forces soldiers that have been recruited by DARPA, the Defense Department's Research and Development Wing, and they're retrained in various scientific disciplines to basically protect our shores against various threats, as I call them. They're basically scientists with guns.
Okay, now, in every book that you do, especially the Sigma Force novels, you kind of have a little hook here with historical things. And right. This time it's the Knights Templar.
Right. I'm always looking for, when I begin a book, I'm looking for that piece of history that ends maybe in a question mark, something that I can maybe solve during the between the covers of this book. In this case, I was tackling the Knights Templar. And the Knights Templar have gotten a lot of press. There's a lot of mystery and mythology about that group. They go back to the time of the Crusades, where they were defending pilgrims on the way to the Holy Land, and eventually built into a major banking industry across Europe until they were disbanded by a French king and the papacy, who drove them out of business. But as a consequence, a lot of history about treasures and mysteries. But I went back to the actual true history of the knights. And the knights were founded by 9 members. There were 9 knights that started that group. Now, in the historical records, 8 of them are listed by name. But the 9th one is referenced, but is never named. And I thought that was a conspicuous absence to not name this 9th knight, somebody that founded this huge, gigantic order. I certainly would want credit if I was one of those knights, but he's never named. And so I thought that was... maybe there's a story there. You know, why was that name erased out of history? What might have been buried with that name? And that became sort of the mystery that is answered in the pages of this novel.
With anything that you do like this, historical, do you do it just for the research? Because it seems like the Sigma Force, I mean, you know, guns, and it's a fantastic international thriller, actually.
Right.
So maybe you don't have to do as much research for that as you would for the historical references?
I do both. I mean, besides that piece of history that ends in a question mark, I'm always looking for that piece of science that makes me go, you know, gee whiz, or what if. And so there's that aspect of the book, and that's usually the modern part of the story. And so the modern part usually is a lot of scientific research involved in that. And I love doing research. That's one of the things I enjoy most about writing this novel. And I actually made a commitment to myself that I'm only allowed to research for 90 days. And the 91st day, I actually have to start putting words on paper. Otherwise, I will just keep researching, thinking I'm working, but I'm not.
Because you're doing a book a year.
It's sometimes two.
Two.
This year, 2 books.
Because you have different series, actually, that you work on. So it might not just be a Sigma Force novel that you put out during the year, but it might be another series.
Right. I've been also doing a middle school series, sort of a young boy archaeologist who gets into a bunch of mischief. And this January, I have the first book of a trilogy that's coming out called The Blood Gospel. Unfortunately, I'm not able to give much information about that because I've been sworn to secrecy by my publisher because there's a little bit of a controversial content to that book. But it comes out January 8th.
Well, it's a good thing in your water that we gave you, we have truth serum, so we'll get to that later. Bloodline, tell me a little bit about the book.
Well, this summer's adventure, the president's daughter is kidnapped off of a yacht in the Indian Ocean. And Sigma's called in to rescue her. And they recruit a unique team for this book, a former Army Ranger and his military war dog. Basically use the dog's nose to help them hunt for the president's daughter, who's been hidden in a camp somewhere in the jungles of Africa, and they need to find out where she was taken. But more importantly, they need to find out why she was taken. And what they discover is the target of the abduction is not necessarily the daughter, but her unborn child, because this child may or may not hold the genetic key to immortality, which is the big scientific crux of this novel.
So do you believe in immortality?
Initially, you know, some people ask, where do you get your ideas for your book? In this case, I usually have a hard time answering that because I don't even know. But in this case, I can say I bought it off of a grocery store shelf. Nice place to buy an idea. But I was standing in line at a grocery store, and there was a bunch of magazines sitting next to you, and I was waiting. I'm looking, you know, just sort of perusing the various covers. And Time Magazine for that week had this cover. I still can picture in my head. 2045, the year man becomes immortal. I kept looking at that date, 2045. Thinking, you know, I'm going to be around in 2045, at least I hope so, knock on wood. That seemed impossible that we're that close to achieving immortality. Immortality within our lifetime, that seemed impossible. And so I spent about a year doing a bunch of research on really what's going on in that industry. How close really are we to that? And what I found out is that there's some amazing things going on in different labs around this country right now, and around the world for that matter, but also some things that when I read about them and investigated them, were actually quite chilling. And we cover sort of both of those extremes in this book, from things that are amazing to things that probably are going to cause people to not want to know so much.
Do you really want to live that long anyway, right?
That's the other question I raise. You know, if you can live forever, would you live forever? It's one of those moral questions that is I love to pose in these books that challenge the readers and my characters.
Just like a good theory here, I guess, would the government allow that to happen for people to live forever? It seems like that the Earth could be overpopulated.
Right.
They're not really going into outer space, having anything.
That is
on
one
Mars
of the big concerns is, number one is the financial concern. Who gets the key to immortality? Is that freely offered? Is only for a select few? Is it only people that can afford that? And if it is freely given, then what do you do? What about overpopulation? How do we stem that? And even from a humanitarian standpoint, how does humans change? How does culture change if immortality? If we have an infinite number of tomorrows, do you start putting off things until tomorrow? Then do you have an infinite number of tomorrows? Does inertia set in? Does boredom set in? Does that stagnate human progress simply because we just aren't so concerned about trying to get cramming everything into this the narrow span of our current lifespan?
One of your protagonists has a dog, maybe even a couple dogs in some of the other books, perhaps.
Well, yeah.
How much research did you have to do on dogs in the service like that?
Well, being a veterinarian, I've got a lot of background in dogs. And you will see animals peppered throughout my novels. You know, I had an orphan jaguar cub in one book, and still to this day, that cat gets more fan mail than I think any other character I created. So when it came to this book, I was on a USO tour to Iraq and Kuwait about a year and a half ago. It was great meeting the men and women in the field. But again, being a veterinarian, I'm like, they got dogs here. Look, there's dogs. So I gravitate towards the dogs, and I was just curious, spoke to a few of the handlers, trying to find out, you know, how were they utilizing these dogs? How do they view the dogs? Do they just consider dogs to be military hardware? And I found it's far from that. They have a very deep bond between dog and handler. They eat together, sleep together, train together. That over time, they even had developed they have a phrase called, it runs down the lead, saying that over time, the emotions of the dog and handler travel up and down that leash, binding them together. One of the soldiers said, you know, I think my dog understands me better than my wife does. So it was that type of bond that I really want to try to capture in this book, that intimate relationship between dog and handler. But as a veterinarian also, I just wanted to try to portray dogs as they really are. Disney has a tendency to, you know, anthropomorphize their animal characters, and I didn't want to do that in this book. So I wrote some scenes in this novel from Kane's perspective, the dog's perspective, to try to take my reader and put them in the paws of that dog, to experience the way that dog would really experience the world, not just a four-legged soldier or a human with four legs. I wanted to make Kane a real character, a real dog. So again, I took my background as a veterinarian, but I also did some interviews with various animal psychologists, discovered how deep the emotional world is of a dog, tried to capture that in print. So already, Kane might be giving Tor that orphan jaguar cub a run for the money, because I'm already getting a lot of fan mail for Kane.
And that's hard to believe that you get fan mail for for the people in the book.
Oh, it's amazing what happens, yeah. I mean, there's There's, you know, I'm very active on Facebook, probably too active on Facebook. And I love that intimacy of having that contact with my readership. And we never had that before as authors. We were always, you know, sitting in our little private offices and we occasionally go out for a book signing. But nowadays you can have that almost, you know, immediate reaction. So, you know, I will post things to my Facebook audience. I will say, you know, I'm thinking of doing this or doing that. And it's great getting that feedback. So that's how I can know that already just a lot of feedback in regards to Kane. In this book, I doodle all my books when I sign them. I put a different unique doodle to every book. And so in Facebook, I posed three different doodles for this book. And of course, the one that won was a little doodle of a dog's head. So even Kane wins off in the doodle battle.
What's the challenge with balancing writing and Facebook and other things like that?
I'm fairly structured in my writing day. I write 5 double space pages a day. I'm a slow writer. It takes me an hour to write a page. So, but that's still a 5-hour day, which is not a full work day. So I still have time to do research or to do some editing or in this case to, you know, hop on Facebook and spend way too much time on Facebook. But again, I think that's important nowadays for authors to have that relationship with their readers. It's a different world out there.
With your ebook, about how many people do you have following you, and how many would you say are actively writing to you a lot?
Well, I can actually answer that since we do have those stats from Facebook. I currently have 75,000 followers, and we run generally engagement is around 5,000, where 5,000 people are actively engaging on the site.
So if somebody loves the Sigma Force novels, other books, James Rollins, they can befriend you, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. Anytime. More the merrier.
You know, I was watching something on television the other day. I think it was on television. I don't think I dreamt it. But there's something out there now that you can put on your computer and you speak into a microphone, and it actually writes the words.
Yeah, there's there's Dragon Dictation, there's a few other programs like that. I tried using one of those at one point, and it just doesn't work for me. For some reason, I need to be able to actually type the words out. For some reason, actually speaking the words is a little more difficult for me to write in that manner.
So as an author, you're kind of fine with that? To me, it seems like it's almost cheating.
Yes, you don't have to learn how to type. I had to learn how to type. That's unfair. Different authors do different things. I mean, I'm always surprised at different authors' processes. One author told me that he works his first draft while he hikes. He just has a tape recorder, and he writes his book as he hikes. I cannot imagine how that guy's head works. That is just a weird way of looking at being able to work.
I've even heard of somebody writing down snippets and putting them in a tub, and then he goes
I don't know who that is.
Puts them together. It's not you.
No, it couldn't possibly be me.
Let's go back and find out how these books have progressed with the people that you have in.
Right.
How have they aged?
Well, that's what I like about writing a series is that you're not limited to just the arc of one book. You get to take these characters over a much longer arc. And so the main character, Gray, at the very beginning of the book, he finds out that his father has been diagnosed having the early stages of Alzheimer's. And over the course of this book, we've seen him trying to balance his professional and his personal life as his parents begin to deteriorate. First his father, then his mother begins to fade because of just trying to caretake. And I think we've all done that. It's one of the great ways to personalize a character is to make your reader be able to relate to that character. And I think we've all tried to struggle with balancing personal and professional lives. And just so when you see Gray going through the same thing, you recognize that there's a bonding that occurs sort of magically between reader and character that way, so that when I dangle Gray off the edge of a cliff, you're going to be concerned if he falls. Whereas if you're not attached to that character, if he just seems like a cardboard cutout, you're not going to be overly invested whether he tumbles to his death or not.
Well, how do you get there? I mean, just from reading the series, I mean, the very first one, you want more and more and you love him more and more?
You know, when I was never planning on writing a series. All my early adventures were standalones. I was getting a lot of pressure from the publishing house, give us a series, because they can promote series easier. And I resisted. And I resisted because of what I call the Murder, She Wrote syndrome. Jessica Fletcher every week would stumble across a dead body. I've never stumbled across a dead body, but every week she does. over a period of time, you begin to suspend disbelief because that keeps happening to her. You know, personally, I think the last episode of Murder, She Wrote should have been the revelation that Jessica Fletcher was a serial killer and that she was killing everybody off and framing other people. I was disappointed it did not end that way. So that's one problem with series. And the other problem with series is as much as you want Jessica Fletcher to die in an episode, she never does. Because you know she's going to be in next week's episode. So it's hard to maintain jeopardy. So when I, in Sandstorm, which is what I describe as the prequel to the actual Sigma series, I introduced Sigma. And I knew when I created that group of characters, these scientists with guns, that there was more stories to tell with this group. And that with a group, the jeopardy can come from many different directions. It just didn't require one character to constantly be getting into trouble. And because it's a group, everybody's in jeopardy because nobody is safe. I can kill off a major character and always replace them with somebody else. So that's the way I got around that, skirt around the Murder, She Wrote syndrome.
So with your Sigma Force novels and the other series that you have you ever just wanted to go in and kill them all off? And is that how the book, is this how the series is going to end?
I've done some major killings, and there's I don't think I'll, at this point, I anticipate there'll be a few more books in the Sigma Force series. I don't know how that, the ultimate end of the series will be. Hopefully not a major bloodshed and wiping out the characters, because I've grown attached to them. And that is one of the problems I weren't really, one of the dangers I did not realize when I started the series was that I would grow attached to these characters. Like, I don't want to kill this character. In one of the novels, one of the major characters looks like he died. And I left the book that way, and I knew he really hadn't died. It was a red herring. That's sort of a surprise for the new novel after that. But oh, did I get hate mail. So now I have to sort of balance exactly how much do I really want to kill off a really major character. So that, you know, they become a part of you. I mean, I've been writing Gray and Company for 8-9 years now that, you know, sometimes I swear if I'm going to walk around the corner, I'm going to see Gray standing there because he's almost like a, you know, my long-lost brother out there, so... But it doesn't mean it won't kill him.
But when you were getting hate mail, did that kind of scare you about going outside, or did you think it was kind of funny?
It was sort of funny. It was never that drastic. He's like, I couldn't believe you killed so-and-so, and I'll never read you again. Well, just read the next book. Please.
Things will all work out in the wash. All right, now, you know, not only an author, you used to work with animals a long time ago.
I still do.
I do.
People say that you're a former veterinarian. No, I'm not. I'm still a veterinarian. I still have my license. I still work with a group that traps feral cats in the Sacramento Valley area. They bring them to the shelter. I spend one Sunday a month, 8 hours spaying and neuter. My greatest claim to fame, it's nice being on the New York Times list, but, you know, I could still neuter a cat in 30 seconds. So, you know, I still have that craft. So, like I jokingly say, all I do with my veterinary degree now is I remove genitalia. That's about it. But I still am a vet.
Well, you know, I guess that you don't have to look at that for your livelihood is where I'm going.
Well, exactly. That has switched. My clients used to ask me, you know, what my long-term goal as a writer was because it became suspicious that I was a writer. You know, in my lobby I had, you know, get your cat spayed, get a free book. So they began to ask me questions about why I'm writing. One of the questions they used to ask me is, why don't you write about a veterinarian? Why don't you write a James Herriot-like novel, All Creatures Great and Small? My answer was, well, not enough people die in those James Herriot novels. I want to go on adventures. I'm working 14, 16, 18 hours as a vet. I don't want to go home and write about a veterinarian. I want to go on these vast creative adventures. So to me, it was always an escape for that. But the other question I often get asked is, what's your long-term goal? You got a successful practice. What are you going to do with this writing? And for, you know, 15 years, my veterinary degree was my paycheck and my writing was my hobby. And it's sort of nice that I've sort of flipped that around. I now write full time. So that's my paycheck. And removing genitalia is now my hobby.
So when did it come to you that, hey, you know, I kind of want to become an author. I want to write books. Were you sending out scripts to patients with like a whole chapter?
I wanted to be a writer from a young age. I also wanted to be a veterinarian from a young age. I got that assignment that all elementary school teachers eventually give their students is, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I remember sitting there as a third grade version of myself at my desk in my bedroom. It was a point of moral dilemma. I knew I wanted to be a veterinarian, fill out the essay as such, but I just didn't know how to spell it. So I did the one thing all third graders hate to do. I actually got the dictionary and looked it up. But I also was an avid reader. And, you know, I grew up with three brothers and three sisters, and you do the math, at 7 kids. We were raised Polish Roman Catholic. You had to have at least 6 kids or you couldn't have the Polish flag in your window. So mom had a spare just in case something happened. So those were my first audience. And my goal was to terrorize my brothers and sisters, to tell them stories, to see what I can get them to believe. You know, I call it storytelling. Mom called it lying, you know, tomatoes, tomatoes. But that, you know, and I write a lot, so that's like throwing gasoline in that little twisted corner of my head. So I thought it would be great one of these days to be able to write. But there was no clear path to authorship. There's not, you do this, and you're published. You know, it's a lot of luck involved. It's a lot of, chance. And, whereas being a veterinarian, you do this, and this, you get your veterinary degree. So I, you know, I pursued that, but I kept reading, and I dabbled with writing a little bit. And out of college, you're sort of the low man on the totem pole. You had to carry the emergency beeper around. Didn't seem to have any time. Years went on, and eventually I thought, well, if I'm ever going to do this, I better try it. So I started writing short fiction, stuff that's now safely buried in my backyard. Hopefully never see the light of day. But that began, you know, my dabbling into writing, and then I tackled my first novel, and I was lucky enough to see my first novel sell.
No, not only do you dabble in writing a lot of things like that, but you also lead classes on how to write novels. There was a great author one time that told me that if you want to learn how to write, read a lot. Maybe that was you.
That could have been me. Yes, that is one of my old adages. Because I firmly believe, you know, if you have any problem with your writing during the day, whatever problem you're having, if you're reading a book at night, you're going to find that solution. Because I've had no formal training in writing, and if you read in my novels, you'll say the same thing. He's had no formal training in writing. I'm not selling my book very well here. I probably shouldn't say that. but yeah, I firmly believe that there's tools to the craft. I think you have to be a natural storyteller. I think that that's where maybe the talent people talk about for an authorship, for an author is that you need to have sort of a mind that likes to tell stories, that has the antenna to collect those ideas and produce story ideas. But I think that the craft of writing, the toolbox you need to tell a story is something that can be taught.
Not only a thriller like Bloodline here, Sigma Force novels, international thrillers, you write other genres. Tell me about those.
I do, under a different pen name, James Clemens. I've dabbled with fantasy, and despite the rumors of the premature death of James Clemens, he apparently has been resurrected. So I'll be working on a third of the series that was stopped a while back. I figured if George R. R. Martin can skip 7 years between novels, I could do the same.
So how does your other name, if you will, write different than James Rollins?
They're very different, and I like that difference. For the first 7 years of my career, I was writing one thriller and one fantasy a year. And it was nice alternating between the two of them, because thrillers are generally staccato-paced. They're plot-driven. They're very lean and mean. Whereas with fantasy, being that the big structure of fantasy writing is world-building, they're a little bit more languid. They're a little more richer in prose. You're allowed to describe thing and build a world layer by layer. You know, what's the mythology of this world like? What's the religion of this world? What's the government like? What's the political structure of that world? So it takes a while to layer that onion up. And so it's nice being able to switch those two gears, right? You know, staccato-paced thriller, and once I'm done with that, switching gears and going to something that's a slightly different pace.
About the hardest interview I ever had was with a fantasy author. It was book number 18, and I couldn't get into it. And these things are like 1,045 pages or so.
I believe that all fantasy writers should sign in blood a guarantee that they were going to end a book at a certain number. So,
well, I ask him if I had to read the very first one to find out what was happening, because I was totally lost. I didn't tell him that. And he said, yes, you have to start from the beginning. Well, now I knew, so he didn't tell me a whole lot about it. But
generally, you know, most of the fantasy books are one big long story told in multi-volumes. Usually it's nice if a fantasy can have a satisfying conclusion with each story. But generally the bigger arc goes throughout the course of the series. But like I said, it's nice to have a defined end to that series so that at least the reader can know that there is an end to the series.
A Sigma Force novel series. You don't have to read the very first one to get into this.
And that is a big difference between fantasies and thrillers, is that, you know, these are self-contained stories. Yes, if you read them in order, there's a certain arc of character that you will capture that way. But I would say 70% of the people that read my novels don't read them in order. They encounter the book somewhere midstream, and they go back or forward, and they mix and match. And the books can be enjoyed that way just as much as read in order.
JamesRollins.com. Tell me about your website.
Well, besides Facebook, again, I have a great website. At least I think it's a great website. Great information about the book, but I also have a large section about tips on writing, tips on publishing. Rather than, you know, if you're any wannabe writers out there, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Some of us have, you know, tread the path, and I'm happy to point to some road markers along the way, so that you don't get too lost in the weeds.
Hey, you have some great tips on writing, finding an agent. You know, you mention in your book, too, that you have to kind of have, or on your web, you have to have thick skin because you may get rejected.
I don't think may is any part of the thing. I think you will get rejected.
And you have some great tips there on how to go, how to move on, I guess.
Again, right. Because a lot of writers, and I've again, like as you mentioned, taught classes and give different instructional panels. And one of the things that writers have been just astounded, they will get one rejection, they will stop. Or they get three rejections, they will stop. Something's, they are intimidated by those rejections. Well, I had 49 different rejections for that first novel. It was the 50th agent that agreed to represent that book. And I'm not talking about, you know, kind rejections. There were some pretty nasty ones. You know, usually you get the form rejection. Dear ma'am or sir, we hate your novel. Don't submit to us again. Editor. But occasionally some editor might be kind enough to write your personal note, you know, this character was pretty good, the rest of your novel still sucks, don't submit to us again. But you can survive as a writer for a long time on that character was pretty good. So one St. Martin's Press editor once sent me a rejection letter, again, form rejection letter, but he has written me a special note, it's three words, this is unpublishable. I thought, well, it's nice of him to reject me, but take the extra special time to kick me in the nuts besides. So, yes, it is you need thick skin out there. If I stopped at 45, it would not be published today. So you just have to, you know, be diligent out there. And it's a new world, you know, ebook publishing. There's a lot of great stories, huge success stories of people publishing on their own. So there's a whole new route now to becoming a writer that does not require the gatekeepers in New York.
Did you save any of the rejection slips?
And every single one of them.
Did you write to him afterwards?
No, but I did see that one St. Martin's Press editor. I see him occasionally at different conferences, and he now runs when he sees me because I've been needling him constantly.
You know, if you want a fantastic read, a page-turner, and a lot of action in here, a Sigma Force novel, Bloodline, is a fantastic book to start in this series, but I'm sure... Hey, you're going to want to pick them all up. Might as well start from the beginning. There's a thread through there, right, James?
Exactly.
All right, and check out jamesrollins.com. Look at his other books. He's got a link on there that will pretty much tell you about each book.
Right.
And if he'll be in an area where you're at, and you can go meet the author.
Fantastic.
James, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with James Rollins, author of his brand new book, Bloodline. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.